Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Members of the Ohio Rights Group have cited the economic and social benefits of legalizing marijuana, but in light of some new research, perhaps they should consider a partnership with the Campaign to End Obesity. Results recently published in the American Journal of Medicine found that pot smokers are significantly slimmer than those who abstain. And here to assure us that researchers were not stoned when they conducted this study, although maybe you can't do that, is Lindsay Abrams, editorial fellow at the Atlantic Health Channel. Welcome to the show, Lindsay.
Hi, great to be here.
So, for years, and not from any personal experience, we've been hearing that smoking marijuana gives you the munchies. And yet, despite a well-documented increase in post-pot smoking snacking, those who smoked had smaller waistlines and those who didn't. That's kind of amazing.
It is, and I wasn't there to see the research conducted, so.
Can't vouch for them, huh?
I can't vouch for them, but, you know, I read through the study and this does seem to be what they found. And there have been studies in the fact that found that people who smoke marijuana end up eating as many as 600 extra calories per day. But these researchers still, despite that, found a reduction in waist circumference among people who identified as current pot smokers, meaning not in the past, but something that they were doing within the month of the study.
And when we talk about current pot smokers, is there any definition as to how often, social, weekly, daily, that kind of thing?
They didn't look into how often people smoked or even how much they smoked. This was just plainly identifying as a smoker or not.
And, okay, so it wasn't even broken up into frequent users or rarely used or anything like that?
No, just current and people who had tried it in the past. And they did find some similar outcomes to people who had previously used marijuana but didn't currently. Maybe those were effects that carried over, but the results they saw here were to a much lesser extent.
My guest, Lindsay Abrams, editorial fellow at The Atlantic. We're talking right now about some new research that shows that people who smoke pot tend to have smaller waistlines, among other things. The study controlled for things like age, activity level, alcohol consumption, so they weren't just pitting pot-smoking marathon runners against lazy non-smokers, right?
Right, that wouldn't quite be fair.
No.
And now what they also found, in addition to waist circumference, was that these people seemed to have better blood sugar control. So their insulin levels were lower, and they had lowered insulin resistance, which is a condition associated with diabetes, wherein the body has trouble absorbing glucose from the bloodstream. They also had higher levels of what we call good cholesterol. So it would seem that marijuana might be useful in helping people to manage their blood sugar. They're not exactly sure yet how that might work, and it's far from being something that doctors are going to prescribe for diabetic patients, but it's definitely something that researchers are going to look into.
It's at this point, it's correlation. We don't know the cause.
Exactly.
Have you looked into other studies like this? Have prior results suggested the same health benefits from smoking pot?
There have been other studies that have come out that have found similar things about people counterintuitively being thinner despite eating more when they're smoking. This is the first to suggest that the blood sugar control might be part of it.
You also did a study roundup that was printed in the magazine all about the ways that environmental stressors affect pregnancy. And one interesting piece of this was how stress affects the probability of having a boy or girl.
Yes, this was really interesting. We know that there is an effect of stress. When the mother goes through stress while she's pregnant, there are results that can follow the baby that's born throughout its life. But one of the first things that researchers see is that when there is stress, you're more likely to give birth to a girl than a boy. And they think that might be because male fetuses are more fragile and more susceptible to being miscarried. But it's very hard for researchers, obviously, to study stress because they can't really design experiments where they're stressing out pregnant women. Obviously, that would be unethical. So what's really interesting and what I looked into for the June issue of The Atlantic magazine are what they call natural experiments. There are these things that occur to a certain population of women that researchers can then go back and see how it affected them. So that can be a time of famine.
Okay.
It can even be Ramadan occurring while Muslim mothers are pregnant.
Because they're not eating as much or as regularly.
Exactly. So, for example, Arab mothers in Michigan, researchers found, were 10% less likely to have a son if Ramadan occurred early in their pregnancy.
Interesting. What other is that the food is one environmental stressor. Was there any other way to any others that they used?
Yeah, they've also looked at natural disasters like earthquakes. They've looked at times of war, especially if a violent event is unexpected. So in September of 2001, in the United States, a woman's chance of miscarrying a male fetus was much higher. And that was across the country, you know, that kind of national trauma seemed to affect mothers. They've also looked at the Israel-Lebanon War of 2006, uh-huh. where there was a sudden onslaught of rocket attacks. And at the same time, they found differences in birth outcomes. In this case, the babies born were more likely to be premature and underweight as compared to siblings from the same parents that were born during peacetime.
And when I first started talking with you about this, I was thinking, well, this is before the gender is identified, but this is not necessarily, doesn't have anything to do with that necessarily. It just has to do with the birth rate of boys versus girls.
Exactly. It's who ends up making it to term.
The good news here, I guess, is that while a dirty environment hurts a developing fetus, cleaning it up a little bit can really help. There was a study about that. Tell us, with EasyPass.
That one led to a great headline that EasyPass led to healthier babies. And the story behind that is they looked at mothers living in New Jersey and Pennsylvania near major highways.
Which use EasyPass, which I guess we should describe what that is first.
Exactly. So EasyPass is the system by which cars no longer have to stop and physically pay a toll. Instead, they have, you know, the little monitor in their car and they can kind of buzz right through. And what happens is that when the traffic stops stalling in those places, the air pollution is lessened in those areas. And so what they found is that for these mothers living near an EasyPass station, when they became pregnant after it had been installed, premature birth fell, and so did low birth weight. So it seemed like they were having healthier babies.
Unintended consequence?
I would say so, but a great one.
A very good one. Anything else? Any other correlations they found with EasyPass?
Those were the major findings.
Less road rage?
That was probably something, too, maybe for a different study. The cool thing about all of this is that the more researchers can understand the effects that stress have, the next step will be for them to start implementing therapies, maybe something like yoga or meditation, and to see if it can improve birth outcomes for mothers who couldn't avoid, you know, the earthquake or the air pollution or whatever else is causing the stress.
And I wonder, we talk about earthquakes, it could be tornadoes, like what happened in Oklahoma. I mean, that's how many women there were pregnant.
And right. I would imagine there are researchers on their way out there right now looking to see what happened.
This may come as no surprise to the cynics out there, but you reported on a study that found that examining your Facebook profile makes you not only conceited, but a little stupid.
That seems to be what this study was suggesting.
Again, correlation, not necessarily cause, but...
Right. We're not accusing anyone of anything. But what these researchers did is they took college students, naturally, and they had them spend either 5 minutes looking at their own Facebook profile or looking at a stranger's. And sure enough, the people who looked at their own Facebook profiles walked away feeling pretty good about themselves. And that makes sense because when you're making your social media profile, you're kind of have this ability to put your best self forward. You know, you're showing all the fun things you've been up to, the pictures you look good in. It's, you know, a little different than just looking in the mirror.
No, it's like reading one of those holiday letters over and over and over again.
Exactly. And even though we know we're doing that, people still seem to fall for it.
And they read it.
But what was interesting about this is that after they stoked people's ego a little bit, they gave them a math test. They had to count backwards by sevens, which I tried that myself. It's very hard to do. And it wasn't that the participants were stupider. They were just as good at counting backwards as people who hadn't been looking at their own Facebook profiles. But they did seem to be a little bit lazier. They didn't try as hard. They got through fewer numbers. And what the researchers' theory is that the people became so complacent by feeling good about themselves that they didn't feel it was necessary to prove themselves in any other ways.
I'm popular on Facebook, therefore.
Exactly. And so this just applies to one test, but you can kind of see how that might come into play in other situations.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. So the question is, do I fawn over my Facebook page and feel good about myself, or do I ignore it and maybe live on the edge a little bit more?
That could be it. And it could just be that, you know, looking at your social world, all the friends you have to keep in touch with is just distracting you from concentrating on anything else. That's my own alternative theory.
Okay. There is a song from the South Pacific, the movie, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, which says that prejudice is not natural. It's something we learn. But what's shocking, according to one study that you saw, is how young kids are when they learn it. Tell us about the British elementary schoolers.
All right. This one was definitely disturbing to me. What these researchers at the University of Leeds in England did is they wrote this simple storybook. It was about two friends, Alfie and Thomas, whose cat gets stuck in a tree. So the kind of things students would see. But the book came in three versions. In one, they were normal, you know, thin, kind of regular-looking little boys. In one of the characters, Alfie, is in a wheelchair, and in the third, he is obese. And these are all conveyed in the illustrations. And so what happened was, when the children were read this version of the book where Alfie was obese, they tended to like him a lot less. They asked the kids a bunch of questions, and the kids responded, well, the fat version of Alfie is probably less likely to do well in school than his thin friend Thomas. He probably feels bad about the way he looks. He probably doesn't even get invited to parties. And there was only one child out of a classroom of 43 kids, who said he would choose Alfie, the fat one, as a friend over the regular one, Thomas. So these kids were 4 to 6 years old, very young, and they were already coming away with this very biased view of somebody based on his weight.
What about the child in the wheelchair? Anything learned from that?
You know, the kids were a little bit biased against the character in the wheelchair. They thought he might not get as many to parties also, but this was to a much less extent than the fat character. So they were much harsher critics of Alfie when he was overweight than when he was in a wheelchair.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about discrimination based on appearance coming up on All Sides. Lindsay Abrams, editorial fellow at The Atlantic. Lindsay, your fellowship ends at the end of the month. This is our last conversation with you, unless something pops in the future somehow. And I just want to wish you well going forward.
Thank you so much.
So Lindsay, once again, Lindsay Abrams of The Atlantic. Coming up, we are going to talk about discrimination based on appearance in the examination room of maybe your very own doctor. We'll be right back. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Wednesday night, WOSU-TV takes you across the country on North America's most spectacular railways. More than just a tour, Trains Around North America traces railroad history. The show recounts the unforgettable stories of the continent's historic and scenic tourist railroads. From quiet and relaxing trains featuring spectacular meals and views to fast-paced trains full of glitz and glamour. All aboard for Trains Around North America, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com.
Spend your mornings and afternoons getting the best in NPR news and information. 89.7 FM brings you NPR News 7 days a week.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We all know the feeling sitting in our doctor's office, barely clothed, waiting for her or him to glance disapprovingly at our blood pressure reading or lecture us about losing weight. It's uncomfortable, of course. But for many people, especially those with disabilities, physician biases aren't easily brushed off. All too often, biases lead to patient discrimination and compromised care. Dr. Tara Lagu is a researcher at the Center for Quality of Care Research at Bay State Medical Center, where she investigates issues of patient discrimination. She joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lagu.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You conducted a study recently, which was sort of simple but clever, where you invented a patient and tried to book appointments with some 250 physicians' offices. First of all, tell us about the profile of the patient and how you came up with it and if it was based on anyone real.
Well, it's a great question. I work as a hospitalist, which is a doctor who takes care of patients in the hospital. And what I'd found over the course of practicing in several different cities over about a 10-year period was that many of my patients who used wheelchairs were having difficulty getting appointments with doctors. One patient in particular comes to mind. I said, how is it that you haven't seen a urologist yet? You clearly have a problem that needs to be cared for by a urologist. And the family said, oh, we'd love to see a urologist. We just can't find a urologist who will see our mother. And I thought, well how could that be? And sure enough, it turns out that many doctors are unable to make appointments for patients who use wheelchairs. And we researched the literature a little bit and found out that, indeed, patients who use wheelchairs have longer waits to see doctors, they're much less likely to be examined, and often don't receive preventive care that is needed. So I started to wonder why this was, and I wondered if maybe it was because doctors were just not making appointments for patients, so there were other barriers to being seen and getting good care.
It wasn't the doctor, him or herself, who was booking them.
Well, correct. So, but we didn't know where the barriers were exactly. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, if we called offices and specifically asked them, hi, we're researchers, would you see a patient who used a wheelchair? We weren't sure that we would get an honest answer. And so instead, we decided to do a study where we developed a hypothetical patient, and we developed a patient who had sort of a wide variety of medical problems for a lot of different medical and surgical subspecialists. And then we proceeded to call 256 doctors, 8 different kinds of doctors in 4 cities across the country, and we just asked them. We said, hi, I'm a doctor calling from Bay State Medical Center. I have a patient I need to make an appointment for, and I'm wondering if you can see her. She uses a wheelchair. She's 200 pounds. And she's not able to move herself from her wheelchair to an exam table because she's had a stroke and she can't move half of her body. And then we proceeded to find out what they said. Could they see her or not? And if they said they could see her, we asked them, okay, what's your plan? How are you going to examine her? Are you going to have a lowering exam table that will allow you to safely move her from her wheelchair to an exam table? Or will you have a lift? Or are you going to just kind of hitch her from a low wheelchair to a high examining table that doesn't lower and just have people in the office do it? Or are you not going to examine her? And then if they said, oh, no, we can't even see her, then we tried to find out why. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was that of 256 practices, 22%, that was 56, said they wouldn't even make an appointment for the patient. And this was very rarely because the building was inaccessible. So only 9 of those practices was the building the reason that the patient couldn't be seen. More often, for our patient who uses a wheelchair, the practices reported that they were unable to transfer her from a wheelchair to an exam table in order to perform the exam. And this varied across specialties, which makes sense because psychiatrists don't necessarily have to move the patient, while gynecologists definitely do.
Let me break. Isn't this illegal?
It's a good question. There is the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in 1990, and it does say that patients are required to have equal access to medical care. But unfortunately, the Americans with Disabilities Act didn't exactly specify what accessibility means. And enforcement, particularly at the level of the individual doctor, has been pretty scattered. So yes, it is a violation of federal law to tell a patient who uses a wheelchair that they can't be seen, but it doesn't seem like it's really translated into care across the country, across subspecialists, and in private practices.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. My guest right now is Dr. Tara Lagu. She's a researcher at the Center for Quality of Care Research at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield, Massachusetts, where she investigates issues of patient discrimination. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have an example of in which you think you were discriminated against because of a physical disability or some other characteristic in your doctor's office, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Tell us about some of the patients you work with and the challenges to healthcare that they face. Are there a lot of physicians making a lot of other assumptions once they do get them into the examination room?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think that the other kind of astounding thing that we found from the study was that of the accessible practices, over half, so 103 out of 200 accessible practices, were going to transfer the patient in a way that disability experts think is probably unsafe. So an ideal situation for a patient who uses a wheelchair, particularly the patient we're talking about, who weighs a lot, who can't use half of her body, who's at risk for a fall and a fracture, which could theoretically result in the end of her life, this person needs ideally a lowering table and a transfer that would not put her at risk for being dropped. Instead, the majority of offices who were going to see the patient said that they were going to just have nurse's aides lift her from a seated position in the wheelchair to a high non-lowering exam table. This puts her at risk, and in fact, it puts the employees at risk, mm-hmm. too. Interestingly, nurse's aides have the third highest rate of occupational injuries after tractor-trailer drivers and movers. So this is not ideal for the staff who are lifting this patient either. Only 10% of the offices that we talked to had the kind of equipment that is most appropriate for patients who use wheelchairs.
When did you ever call the others back and say and tell them who you were?
We did not call anybody back, but we did. So we're guided by an institutional review board, which reviews our work and makes sure that it's ethical. Mm-hmm. And one of the sort of stipulations of the project was that we did not obtain any informed consent at the time, but we sent a letter out afterwards telling physicians that they had been called. And we did get some calls back from physicians who were angry that they were called and enrolled without their consent. But our idea was that this study was so important that we thought that sort of risking that lack of consent was more important. Additionally, we destroyed all of our data afterwards, so no one can go and find these physicians.
Let me ask you, what did you learn about who is actually making these decisions? In other words, do we know if the staff wants to help, but the physician's too much of a cheapskate to get the proper equipment, or what?
It was so interesting. I mean, I think that some of this is cost. Like, as we get feedback from people about our study, many say, like, this is an unfunded mandate. We're asked to buy equipment that we can't afford. But in fact, there are tax breaks that you can get up to half the money back, up to $10,000 per year. So we're talking about actually a pretty small expense when you think about the amount of money that you can get back. So cost may be part of it. Part of it is time, that to get a patient into a room with a lowering table and then transfer her is going to take probably two appointments rather than one. So that's one an appointment time that the doctor has lost. And we're in an environment where there's a real crunch to try and get every time slot filled because of funding issues for doctors right now. So that's understandable, but still it doesn't explain it. What we found, I thought, was that many of the practices were very willing to say, oh, no, sorry, we don't see that patient. Oh, and we'll tell you why. And that, to me, said that they were just obviously ignorant that this is a violation of federal law to refuse to see this patient. So I think that was one of the primary goals of my study, is to really get the word out, to tell doctors, you know, it's the law to see these patients.
Do you know whether or not, I can't remember if you described when you gave us the description that this person was on any kind of Medicaid or had any kind of financial constraints, and that
we purposefully avoided the insurance issue.
Okay,
there are studies. There's been a recent study that showed that patients on Medicaid had much longer waits for appointments than patients who are not on Medicaid. This is notable because patients who use wheelchairs are frequently on Medicaid because of the nature of their situation.
Right.
Often they're disabled from their illness. So I think it could only make things worse for that subset of patients who use wheelchairs and are on Medicaid, because they could face even longer waits and more difficulty getting appointments.
For those who do take the patients or said they would, what do we know about the experience then after they've gotten into a physician, but maybe they're just going to be too much of a hassle? Does a physician tend to treat them differently in a way that would discourage them from returning, or maybe not provide proper follow-up to discourage them returning?
Well, it's a good question. We know a few things. We don't know specifically that question, but we know that patients who use wheelchairs wait longer to get preventive care, that they have harder times getting appointments, and they report, when you ask them in studies, they report that they experience fear and humiliation and a lot of discomfort with going to the doctor's office. So I suspect that many of these patients feel as though the quality of care that they're getting is less, even if we don't have a quantitative description of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the experience of being a patient in a wheelchair interacting with the medical system is probably a pretty terrible one, and I think it should be our goal as a medical profession to start to try to address that.
And your fictional patient was both disabled and overweight, obese, a double whammy. Were you able to suss out what the problem was or not?
Yes, I mean, the fact that she was obese definitely reduced many practices' ability to accommodate her. And they told us that. They said, oh, if she were lighter, we would take her, but she's too heavy. Additionally, interesting side thing is that this study was written up in the national press quite a bit, and the comments from physicians on the feedback on some of these newspaper stories was fascinating. They were very fixated on the fact that she was overweight and that they were frustrated with seeing patients who are overweight. So it makes me think there is another study to be done here that's specifically about discrimination against overweight and obese people in medical settings.
Well, and the irony is that when you are obese and you decide to start a diet program or an exercise program, they say the first thing you should do is go check with your physician. And it does make you wonder about, this is supposedly we're in an epidemic situation with obesity, and these are the people who aren't able to get in to see a doctor as easily.
It's true. And I think that we are starting to adjust as a profession. The medical world is starting to adjust. I've noticed, I've seen more tables that are kind of the extra large tables. We have more wheelchairs that are the extra large wheelchairs.
I know hospitals have. They have bigger.
Hospitals
yeah.
have them. I think we're starting to adjust, but I think you're right. I think that we have an epidemic of patients who are larger than any we've ever encountered before. And we have to figure out both how to help these patients achieve a more healthy weight and how to take care of them at their current weight. Because so much of the complications of obesity can be prevented if they're addressed early on. And we just have to figure out how to care for these patients better before it's too late.
And do we know anything about children and what kind of discrimination there might be going on for children who are obese? I know you didn't address that in this particular study.
No, I don't know a lot about issues with childhood obesity and discrimination in medical settings. I mean, I'm sure it happens in other settings. And I think, you know, we do have kind of fat phobia as a society, so I would not be surprised. I know that there are many initiatives in terms of research and policy that are focused on trying to reduce childhood obesity, and I hope that some of these become successful, because preventing childhood obesity and reducing childhood obesity is really the way to affect adults.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Dr. Tara Lagu. Thanks for joining us so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Tara Lagu, she's a researcher at the Center for Quality of Care Research at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield, Massachusetts. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator of the TV series Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz. 6 years after this cult hit was canceled by the Fox network, Hurwitz has brought us a new season of 15 episodes on Netflix. People have been binge-watching it all over.
And so, purge-watching it.
And purge-watching it. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. Good for discounts at more than 200 partners. Visit wosu.org/member card.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You remember the tale of the tortoise and the hare, about the slow and steady turtle who beat a cocky jackrabbit in a foot race. Well, it turns out that walkers do beat runners in a couple surprising health measures. And though we may never know the fitness goals of either animal, we can rest assured that both would see reductions in heart disease risk, high blood pressure, and cataracts. Here to settle the score between runners and walkers is New York Times well blogger Gretchen Reynolds. Welcome to the show, Gretchen.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you and I were talking off air, and I'll tell you, I'll say it on air that I had a conversation with someone once. I was a walker. She was a runner. And we figured out you burn the same number of calories or some such thing. And I said, so what's the benefit? And she says, well, you get there faster. Not in the tortoise and the hare, but she was right. If you're busy and you can run 6 miles in 45 minutes versus walk it in an hour and a half,
Yes, and that's when you ask the question, which is better, running or walking, the first thing you have to define is, are people expending the same amount of energy when they do the activity? And the only way you expend the same amount of energy walking is to do it a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
It's at least 1.5 times longer to walk and get the same benefit. And that's if you do it briskly. And if you walk more slowly at a leisurely sort of pace, it's going to take you at least twice as long to burn the same amount of calories as you do running. So that's the first issue is running. I mean, in 20 minutes of running, you are definitely going to burn more calories, expend more energy than in 20 minutes of walking. There also is some evidence that running tends to reduce people's appetite, whereas walking tends to increase it. So if you're trying to lose weight and you walk, then you do have to be really strict about watching how much you eat afterwards.
Interesting.
All that said, though, if you expend the same amount of energy walking, if you really do walk for 40 minutes, then there's very good evidence that you will get at least the same reductions in your risk for heart disease, diabetes, and cataracts, as you mentioned, and potentially more reduction than runners get. So it's a real trade-off, which fundamentally is better.
My guest is Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We're talking about the run versus the walk. Are you a runner or a walker? Why don't you give us a call and tell us what you think? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org.
One thing that I didn't mention in the column, and we are discussing a column that ran last week in the New York Times.
Okay.
It is certainly one disadvantage of running is that you are far more likely to wind up injured than walking. And so if you have a history of injury, or if your knees ache, or if you previously you've hurt your ankle, any of those things, then running is almost certainly not going to be as healthy for you as walking, because you are more likely to get hurt. And people who get hurt then don't exercise at all. And in that case, running or walking is clearly the winning exercise if you want to be able to do it basically your entire life. It's a wonderful thing to do.
Exercise of any kind reduces the risk of heart disease, but for some reason, walking seems to reduce it more than running in the studies. Does that surprise you?
Yes and no. I mean, one thing to bear in mind is when they do these studies, frequently walkers start out less healthy than runners, the people who start walking and the people who start running. So if you haven't been doing much of anything and you start doing any exercise, you lower your risk for diseases so dramatically. I mean, even if you're walking 10 minutes and that's all, you reduce your risk for heart disease and diabetes and also dementia just profoundly and very quickly. So it doesn't completely surprise me that they found actually greater benefits to people who started walking and kept walking than people who started running and kept running. People who run tend to be just in general a little thinner because it's easier if you're thinner to run than to walk. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of sort of self-selection in that. But even so, the big lesson of that is if you have not been exercising much and you start, whether you decide to walk or to run, you get such amazing health benefits and change your life so really dramatically. It's actually pretty remarkable if you read the numbers, how much people can start reducing their risk of dying prematurely if they just walk for 10, 15 minutes a day.
And how important, I don't know if we've talked about this before or not, but how important is it for people to track that kind of thing? So, I mean, does that affect them to know that their blood pressure is better, that, you know, that their cholesterol has changed, that they count, you know, that they pace themselves and realize that they're doing a mile in 10 minutes versus 14 minutes now?
Yes, for most people, seeing progress has been proven to be really motivating. Some people will keep going no matter what, but for most of us, we need to see some kind of results. And one result that people often don't see is dramatic weight loss. Mm-hmm. So don't look at that one. It doesn't matter, honestly, whether you're losing weight, because you are changing your risk of dying earlier than you need to. People who are fit, meaning they have good cardiorespiratory health, live longer by and large than people who are thinner and not as fit. So don't look at weight loss. You're also changing how much fat your body has. You are adding muscle. All of those things are changing. Look at your heart rate. Look at your cholesterol profiles. Go in, have your doctor say, wow.
I cling to those things. I cling to them.
And it definitely does. If you keep track on a little watch or a pedometer or your iPhone app, you can find all sorts of things that will help you track how far or how fast you're going. And it can be really motivating to realize that walking around the block used to take you 15 minutes, and now it takes 12. Mm-hmm. And in another month, it'll take 10. Those things are really, really helpful. So, yes, track your progress. Find a partner. Have a little bit of a competition. See who gets to the 10-minute mark faster. All those things are fun and make it feel less like a chore. I mean, exercise really shouldn't be something that you do because you absolutely have to. I would hope people could start finding ways to make it something that makes their lives feel better.
My guest, Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We talk with Gretchen about fitness programs and so forth. We've been talking about walking versus running today. Are you a walker? Are you a runner? Do you have a preference? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or it's always fun, isn't it, Gretchen, for people to run by their little exercise regimens?
Sure.
It's always interesting to hear how people work on staying or getting fit. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. And you can post it on the Facebook page. That's maybe a little quicker right now if you want to check out the Facebook page. Alex sent us an email. Alex wrote, I've heard this. By definition, when walking, there is never a point when you have both feet in the air. Walking is planting your feet while running is a series of leaps. Is that true?
Yes, basically that is true. Walking, you always have one foot at least partially on the ground. Running, there is a period where both feet are off the ground. The point when brisk walking turns into a jog is a little hard to define mm-hmm. for most people. But yes, that is the primary difference. For most of us, the difference is the speed that we're going at. I mean, you know, you can't really walk a 10-minute mile. You're going to be running.
Yeah, yeah. What is the value of the sprint?
Well, sprinting is really good because it's essentially a form of high-intensity exercise. And high-intensity exercise is very concentrated exercise. It provides almost the same health benefits and in some ways even more of the health benefits of a slower, easier, say, walk in a really concentrated period of time. If running is more concentrated than walking, then sprinting is very concentrated running. And it definitely improves your endurance very quickly. And for those of us who are getting a little bit older, who
those
are not in our 20s.
Who cling to our positive heart rates and, I mean, our health.
It actually becomes very important for people in middle age to occasionally sprint, to do what is fairly intense exercise very briefly, because that seems to be the way to keep your cardiovascular fitness up. Otherwise, we do lose what is known as VO2 max. It's how well your body can take in and use oxygen. And that does become lower as we get older, no matter what. But you can lessen the extent to which you lose your cardiorespiratory capacity if you occasionally sprint. So just, you know, see a tree up ahead of you if you're going out for a walk or a run. Increase your pace. You could even, if you're a walker, just increase your pace to the point where it feels uncomfortable. You don't have to sprint if you think that might injure you or make you feel awful. Just go a little harder for a minute and then go easy again.
614-292-8513. What's your exercise regimen? That's what we're talking about today with Gretchen Reynolds, a columnist for the New York Times. So bottom line, Are you thumbs up for running or walking, or it just depends?
I do both.
Okay.
Running definitely has the advantage in terms of time management. If you only have a little bit of time, you want a good, very useful workout, then run. If you have more time, you don't want to be injured, you like the contemplative aspects of exercise, go for a walk. But know that to get the same health benefits as 20 minutes of jogging, you're going to need to walk for 40 minutes to an hour.
There was some disheartening news about statins lately. They're the drugs that lower cholesterol, and they're very widely prescribed. But a recent study found that they limit the benefits of exercise.
Yes, that was a very disheartening study, actually.
It's like one step forward, two steps back.
Yes, it's a catch-22 situation. In this study, they took a group of people who had been sedentary, who had not exercised, and had at most borderline high cholesterol. Most of them had fairly normal cholesterol. And they put them on statins, half of them on statins, and had all of them begin an exercise program. And the group that were not taking the statins improved their fitness pretty substantially by 10% or more. And the group that were taking the statins did not improve their fitness at all. And some of them actually lost fitness.
Wow. Even though they were exercising?
Even though they were exercising.
Wow.
And fairly intensively. I mean, it was a fairly rigorous, not really hard exercise program, but certainly a program that you would expect people to get quite a bit more fit. And as I said, the group that didn't take the statins did. What the researchers think is that the statins actually blocked the body's ability to respond to exercise. And that is worrisome because exercise has a number of benefits, including that it generally helps you maintain cholesterol levels healthily, and it's very important for living a long, healthy life. So if statins are keeping people from benefiting from exercise, then that's certainly something that needs to be investigated more and that doctors need to be aware of and let their patients know.
We have just a few more minutes, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What a disincentive.
Yes, and it's actually, I mean, I think it's far too early to say, you know, people shouldn't take statins if they want to exercise. Clearly, we need to do a lot. There needs to be a lot more study done.
Yeah.
But there have been also studies that have found that it does affect, it makes people, the statins can make people fatigued and they can make their muscles quite sore.
What do they do exactly?
They block how your body creates and stores cholesterol. And I'm not an expert in the drug interactions. What they did in this study that I wrote about is the statins appeared to affect these structures inside cells that actually provide energy for the muscles. They kept them from working as well, and they kept people from creating new ones. And that's worrisome because it is part of exercise that you become better able to use fuel, the fuel in your muscles, and that you become less tired, not more tired, during exercise. So this is something that I think we really need to have a lot more studies done. And people who are starting statins, you should ask your doctor about the effects. And there's some indications that if your cholesterol isn't really high, perhaps you start exercising first and get fit and then start the statins.
Okay. John in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome, John.
Hi, how you doing? My wife and I are walkers, and we've been using the Metro Parks in and around Columbus, which are great because you can usually choose the length of trail that you want to use based on how much time you have. And so we've been walking pretty regularly since January after school or after work. Uh-huh. And I really like that was mentioned that you look at multiple metrics besides weight loss. That, you know, since January, although I've lost 20 pounds, and my weight's kind of stalled right now, I think, because I'm converting fat mass to muscle, which is, you know, higher density. But the fact that I've, you know, also lost 2 inches on my waist and I feel better and getting around on these various trails is faster, as you mentioned. But the other important piece that we've used that has been really critical for me, and I think it's unique to the person, but my Fitness Pal the application on my iPhone for me and how I think about how I take in energy and burn energy has been really quite amazing, because you watch these bar graphs of all the energy that you're taking in, and when those bar graphs turn from green to red, you know you need to get out on the trail and start walking to bring the amount of calories that you're taking in, compensate it with the exercise, and becomes almost a game. So for me, that's been extremely successful.
All right. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's got to feel good.
It is. It's great.
Yeah. And the Metro Parks.
I'm going for 100 pounds this time next year. We'll see.
Okay. Well, call us and let us know.
Okay. Take
care. All right. Good luck.
Bye.
I want to just grab another quick call. Teresa in Columbus, you're on the air with Gretchen Reynolds. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Fan of the show, Ann. How are you guys?
Fine, thanks. We just got just about a minute, Teresa.
Okay. All right. I just started exercising, and I want to get into jogging. And I'm facing some issues about, like, side stitch. And, after a minute or so running, it just hurts on the side, and I have to hold it while running. And I want to ask advice on how to face those issues and condition my body to start jogging.
Well, the first bit of advice is don't eat before you jog, because that often can contribute to people, especially who are starting to run, having side stitches. But even more, it tends to be how you breathe. And the transition from walking to running can actually be a pretty hard on the muscles in your abdomen as you start breathing heavier. So go very slowly, take really deliberate slow breaths, and try and pull in lots of oxygen. And sometimes that can help, just because it makes you stop thinking about the side stitch. But generally, the best advice is just go slow. If it starts to feel uncomfortable, back off, and then wait a few minutes and try and go a little faster at that point.
Okay, Teresa, good luck with that. Thanks for the call. Gretchen Reynolds, we won't be hearing from you again until the fall. We'll miss you. I hope you have a great summer.
I'm planning to. I hope you do, too.
All right. Take care. Thanks again.
Sure. Bye.
Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.